for 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on September 30th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to talk about Supreme Court history from the early U.S. to Redemption to Lochner to FDR and to present day, including new discussions of court packing and impeachments. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And joining us on the line as usual from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
So we're talking this week about the U.S. Supreme Court. Obviously, it's in the news because of the very high profile and long Kavanaugh hearings. We're going to talk a little bit about that in the middle of the episode, but mostly we're focusing on sort of the bigger picture of the Supreme Court as an institution. And as Rachel said before we were recording, we're going to be talking about some of our big ideas for improving American democracy. And a lot of that includes how we think about and deal with the Supreme Court. One thing I wanted to start off with was this article that got a fair amount of buzz at the beginning of September. We pushed this episode off a few weeks in hopes that the Kavanaugh stuff might be resolved one way or the other, but it seems like it's going to drag on for a bit longer. So, and since that's not the real focus, let's talk about this. Adam Serwer wrote this long article in The Atlantic about the Redemption Court, which is the name of the sort of nickname for the court that followed the U.S. Civil War and the Radical Reconstruction period. This was largely a Republican-appointed court, but as he goes at great pains to show in the historical sections of this article, these were not particularly radical Republicans, and they were not particularly committed to enforcing or upholding some of those more radical Reconstruction elements. And as the 1870s progressed, they continued to issue decisions that drifted further and further away from that promise and basically turned a blind eye or gave implicit permission to Southern Democrats and even some Southern Republicans to, you know, at minimum uphold white supremacy and, you know, start establishing Jim Crow. This is the Redemption Court often is sort of bookended with the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson case, which legalized separate but equal, quote unquote, Jim Crow segregation. And then at worst, they were basically endorsing significant acts of violence and, you know, mass lynchings and things like that. And Serwer talks about some particular incidents, but basically, you know, they would find various loopholes, say, oh, this case wasn't properly handled, you know, therefore has to be thrown out. Or they would, and this is the part that he emphasizes with drawing parallels to the Roberts Court today, these arguments that these justices would make of essentially saying like, oh, this isn't what the 14th Amendment really meant in terms of individual rights. Really, this is only, you know, the 14th Amendment only applies to the relationship between the federal government and the state government. But, you know, if it's non-state actors like the KKK who are doing these acts of violence, or if it's individuals committing acts of discrimination in violation of the Civil Rights Act of the 1870s or civil rights measures of the 1860s, none of this counts. You know, the individual non-state actors, they can do whatever they want because that's not what the 14th Amendment means. And then, of course, Serwer also talks about how as the Redemption Court era proceeded, and Nate, I think you wanted to mention the specific statistic on civil rights cases versus these corporate cases, but they started basically making the argument that the 14th Amendment was really about corporate rights as opposed to individual civil rights. And of course, one of the footnotes in those cases regarding Southern Pacific becomes the basis of Citizens United in the present day era. But at the time, you had former Republican legislators, you know, who would get up there in court and just openly lie and say, oh, this is what we actually meant when we drafted the 14th Amendment, you know, and then just say that, you know, basically what they actually meant was to justify this case. So, Nate, you wanted to talk about that statistic there.
Yeah, just quickly. So we're quotes historian Nell Irvin Painter, writing that the court increasingly used the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to protect corporations from state regulation rather than the civil rights of persons, in case after case. And this is sort of showing the history of the Golden Age here. These decisions outlawed virtually any attempt by states to limit maximum hours of work, of unions to strike, and of the federal government to curb or regulate monopolies or curb the accumulation of vast fortunes. And from Adam Winkler's We the Corporations from 1868 to 1912, so this Redemption Court era, and then into some of the Lochner era, which we'll talk about, I guess. The Supreme Court heard 604 14th Amendment cases. Fewer than 5% involved the civil rights of Black Americans, and civil rights advocates lost nearly all of those. And more than half of all 14th Amendment cases decided by the Supreme Court, 312 in total, involved corporations, which succeeded in striking down numerous laws regulating businesses, including minimum wage laws, zoning laws, and child labor laws.
Yeah, so, I mean, as Nate is suggesting here, the end sort of phases of the Redemption Court era overlaps with what's called the Lochner era. The Lochner era is named for Lochner v. New York, which was a case in 1905 that struck down state legislation limiting weekly working hours. There's a good list on the Wikipedia page for the Lochner era that lists off some of the key cases. This is an era that generally is considered to be about 1897 to 1937 in the New Deal era at the longest, but sort of the heart of it, you know, overlaps a little bit into the Redemption Court era of the 1890s, and you know, was some of it was curtailed by constitutional amendments that came in around, you know, World War I and a little bit before and after that. Those are, you know, the fairly well-known ones. And we've talked a lot about that era in general on this show in recent months. But some of the other cases that they list here, there was a case in 1895 that limited Congress's power to prevent monopolies. They struck down, in 1897, struck down state legislation prohibiting foreign corporations from doing business in the state. They struck down federal legislation in 1908 that prohibited railroad companies from demanding that a worker not be in a labor union as a condition for employment. They struck down, as Nate was alluding to, in 1918, a federal regulation on child labor. And then there were various efforts to strike down the minimum wage. And of course, this continues into the era where they're eventually striking down major pieces of the New Deal legislation, which again, we'll talk a little bit more about that. And so, you know, this Serwer article, I think maybe it's fairly long. I felt like it kind of goes into the weeds and off in a random direction toward the end of the article, kind of talking about not really presenting what sort of solutions should be done about this, but just there are some really good parallels drawn in historically between the way that the Roberts Court interprets things now to say, oh, you can or can't do this, you know, because this is what the founders intended. But of course, they're not consistent with it, as he says. You know, if they need to say federal supremacy applies here to strike down a state law, they'll do it. If they say that they want to uphold the state laws everywhere and that this isn't the federal jurisdiction, then they'll say that. And it's whatever is convenient to their ideology. But he also notes that, like, a lot of this stuff now is very deliberate. Like, they've spent decades working on these legal strategies as opposed to these sort of moderate Republicans in the 1870s who were sort of just winging it in a totally new era. And he's a little bit, the article's a little bit sympathetic to their position of like, well, they couldn't really imagine a world of equal rights and true privileges for everyone. There's a lot of quotes in here about how they're like, well, these, you know, the court, the justice is saying, oh, these laws aren't really intended to be discriminatory. They might have that effect, but they're not that way in the letter of the law, that there were freed Black people before the Civil War and they didn't necessarily get equal rights. So that means we don't have to have equal rights now either. So it was a lot of that kind of stuff. I don't know if I would give them that much, like, you know, sort of benefit of the doubt, so to speak, because I think they were just upholding white supremacy or whatever. But now is a lot of like deliberative strategy. And like, you know, he talks about the voter suppression stuff that we've talked about as well.
Yeah, as Sewer notes, some of the like the grandfather clauses and the literacy tests were upheld basically by saying, oh, this could theoretically affect white people too, so therefore it's constitutional.
Rachel?
I just wanted to point out that along with what you were saying, they said as long as the law didn't explicitly mention the group being discriminated against, intent and effect were irrelevant. So like you're saying, as long as you're not saying, I'm trying to target Black people with this law, you can kind of just go buck wild and do whatever you want with the law. He kind of tied it in with the Muslim ban, even though Trump was saying in rallies and on the news and on his Twitter that he really wanted to target Muslims, because the law wasn't worded that way. It was kind of like, oh, no, he didn't mean that it was only going to affect Muslims. So therefore, it's just kind of, it's all right. It's okay to make a law banning immigration from these countries that just happen to be Muslim majority. It doesn't actually target only Muslims. It's just farcical and obviously on its face, just a bad argument.
Now, in this early part of the Lochner era, so basically the late 1890s through, let's say, about 1910 or so, you had the court striking down a whole lot of legislation, especially at the state level, but sometimes also at the federal level, that was just sort of like extremely basic introductory level progressive measures. This is the progressive era. We've talked about that as well on the show before, of a lot of these, you know, this is when you get these child labor laws, minimum wage laws, various work week regulations. These things start coming in and the unions are negotiating some of them, but in the United States, compared to many countries, a lot of this had to be pushed through at a sort of legal level. And in contrast with, say, the Australian Supreme Court at the time, which was, you know, unilaterally deciding that everyone has a right to a living wage that can support, you know, a family just based on, you know, weekly wages, you have this opposite approach by these conservative justices on the court saying, no, you can't do this and that. Now, this really ran the gamut. I mean, some of these things like, you know, the income tax, I remember they struck that down. They were striking down efforts to create a central bank along the lines of what became the Federal Reserve. A bunch of these things had to be put through, whether they're progressive or not. They had to do various amendments. And you also have in this era, of course, you know, the struggle for the women's right to vote, the Senate being switched to direct elections instead of elections by legislatures. Now, somebody was pointing this out on Twitter, and I was looking this up, that the Socialist Party platform in 1912 really emphasized a lot of these sort of struggles at the time. They mentioned that there were these court decisions that were really impacting a lot of the priorities that they were working on. And so some of their political demands included, you know, more radical proposals than, say, what the progressives were willing to push at the time. They said that they demanded the abolition of the Senate and of the veto power of the president. They wanted the election of president and vice president by direct vote, i.e. abolish the Electoral College, and the abolition of the power usurped by the Supreme Court of the United States to pass upon the constitutionality of the legislation enacted by Congress. National laws shall be repealed only by act of Congress or by a referendum vote of the whole people. Certainly their federal demands were you know, fairly out there, but highlighted sort of the overall problem. Now, as I said, the late sort of period, Lochner era, goes into the struggle for the New Deal, and they were striking down huge pieces of legislation that were critical parts of the New Deal. And this leads us to the sort of famous FDR court packing proposal, officially the Judicial Procedures Reform Bill of 1937. And this comes up a lot, but it's, I think, often sort of poorly discussed. For one thing, it's a very complicated piece of legislation that is not what I would have been proposing if I were in that position. And I think that many historians agree that that was a major problem for it. It allowed the president to appoint one new, younger judge for each federal judge with 10 years of service who did not retire or resign within 6 months after reaching the age of 70 years. So just sort of arbitrarily saying, oh, if you're 70 and a half years old, you have to either quit or we're going to add a new justice to basically cancel out your vote. But, you know, that's sort of a complicated mechanism there, as opposed to just saying we're going to expand the size of the court. Tying it to age and length of service is sort of a weird way of doing it. There was a limitation proposed on the number of judges that any one president could appoint, no more than 6 Supreme Court justices, no more than 2 on any lower federal court, with a maximum allocation between the 2 of 50 new judges just after the bill is signed. Lower level judges should be able to float, roving to district courts with exceptionally busy or backlog dockets. Lower courts be administered by the Supreme Court through newly created proctors. So sort of a complicated piece of legislation. And then the rollout is generally regarded by historians as the major problem there, which is just that he sort of didn't consult the relevant people that he would need to get on board, and kind of it was a bit of a surprise. Although, you know, it's also noted that he did campaign in 1929 on saying, you know, Republicans have control of the White House, Republicans have control of the Congress, Republicans have control of the Supreme Court. You know, all three of the branches are, you know, under the control of one party. So he was sort of foreshadowing that this was probably going to be a showdown, but it was poorly handled and then sort of dropped because some of the justices started being a little more lenient on their decisions. And it's still debated as to whether or not they did that intentionally to preserve their power and avoid this court packing plan, or whether they were just, I guess, more amenable at that point to some of the measures. Ever since then, that's been kind of the standard on this. But one thing I wanted to highlight before we talk again about sort of the present era is that this is not really an accurate reflection of the pre-1937 discussions on what the court should look like and how to deal with that. Nate?
Yeah, so just from a SCOTUS blog, there's a Brown history professor, Timothy Huber, basically talking about the history of court packing. This is titled The First Court Packing Plan, sort of going over the history about, okay, the Constitution doesn't really say how many Supreme Court justices you're actually supposed to have. And during the Civil War, first, the Republican Congress basically tried to squeeze out some of the Southern justices, looping them into two circuits. And this is also back when, justices were all often on the road because they were both Supreme Court justices and federal circuit justices. So, you know, it was very different than it is now. But then in March 1963, Congress created an additional circuit and thus an additional seat on the Supreme Court. And eventually they appointed a 10th pro-union Democrat, Stephen J. Field of California. So appointed, nominated by Lincoln there. So then, as you mentioned, Boyle, also later, they tried to de-pack the court and basically tried to make sure that Andrew Johnson could not nominate any additional justice to try to mess with Reconstruction and stuff like that.
Yeah, and that, I think, you know, that's one that does come up fairly frequently. But like, if you look at the longer arc of history, there's a consistent theme here. The first formulation in 1789, you know, the first Congress had to set up the court, and again, it's a law, not a constitutional provision. They passed an act that created a 6-person court. And then that was under the Federalists, you know, aligned with George Washington. You know, fast forwards, you know, some odd years, and you're now in party politics. So Jefferson and his party, now in control of Congress in 1807, expands that from 6 to 7. Then in 1837, you have Martin Van Buren, a Democrat, as the president. You have a Democratic majority in Congress, and they pass new legislation. They bump that up to 9, which is the first time it gets to the number that we have now. And then, you know, Nate mentions the examples of going up to 10 in 1863. And of course, that's Republican control of the presidency in Congress pushing that through, even though they, you know, appointed a Democrat that agreed with them. And then, you know, they bump it back down under Radical Reconstruction, and then it goes back up to 9 eventually in 1869. And all of that's happening under unified control as well. So this notion that, like, nobody ever tried to pack the court before until FDR just doesn't really line up with history. And even if he maybe, you know, bungled the rollout on that, that doesn't really necessarily tell us anything one way or the other about how we should be approaching the court or thinking about the court. And it, you know, it is sort of inherently a political institution. Before we get into any specific proposals of what to do, you know, the idea of term limits or potential court packing or various other reforms, let's just again circle back to what the present situation with Kavanaugh and to some extent Clarence Thomas. There was actually an article earlier this year, New York Magazine, by Jill Abramson, a colleague of Jane Mayer, who's been one of the people doing a lot of these investigative reports on Me Too allegations. And basically the article original headline was "The Case for Impeaching Clarence Thomas." Then it was revised to "Do You Believe Her Now? It's Time to Re-examine the Evidence That Clarence Thomas Lied to Get Onto the Supreme Court and to Talk Seriously About Impeachment." And that's, of course, focused on Anita Hill and his blatant lying during his confirmation hearings quite some time ago. There's also the fact that, and that's also setting aside for now, the fact that Clarence Thomas has been allegedly groping women ever since then. And, you know, there are many, many people besides Anita Hill that he has victimized. But even setting all that aside, he and his wife have very corrupt connections to these sort of Republican big money machine politics and like think tanks and various things and the, you know, super PACs and all that. And his wife has directly benefited, I think, from a lot of the stuff like Citizens United. Kavanaugh in a similar position, a, you know, know, machine politician.
Really likes the Nationals, apparently.
Yeah, very into the Nationals to the extent of, you know, racking up enormous credit card debts that he insists is all related to Nationals tickets, and very clearly has something fishy going on there. And
gambling. There was an email that came out talking about how he couldn't recall the result of a dice game, but he said he got aggravated. That doesn't really sound like a guy who ever is blacked out drinking, though.
So Kavanaugh, you know, the stuff is still ongoing with the allegations regarding the sexual assault, which we obviously believe. But again, even setting that aside, there's so many other just like blatant corruption questions about debts and, you know, his drinking and his gambling and all this other stuff. And the fact that he's tied very closely into this dark money machinery. It's if he is confirmed, which I think is still a very real possibility, despite the sexual assault allegations and all of that, both Kavanaugh and Thomas would be definitely eligible for impeachment, no question about it. Will that actually happen? I don't know, but we need to start thinking about that. And again, without going too far into it, this is even more of a situation than it was during the New Deal, I would argue, which is that we've got huge crises across multiple fronts, and in particular, climate change. We are going to have to fundamentally reorganize the economy, and especially the energy economy, as we've talked about on Arsenal for Democracy, in order to deal with the threat of climate change. In order to do those, we're going to have a court that doesn't constantly strike it down on BS procedural grounds that they claim the founding fathers wouldn't have wanted, you know, whatever carbon system or something. And that's not really viable if we don't either start removing a bunch of members, whether it's through impeachment, or start passing various reforms. That could involve term limits. That could involve court packing. Let's talk briefly about that before we end the show. Rachel, you wanted to talk about some of these. Where do you want to jump in?
So I wanted to talk about an Atlantic article written in 2014 by Norm Ornstein on the occasion of the 60th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. And he just kind of was comparing the court then versus the court now, or at 2014. He was talking about the increased polarization versus the Warren Court that decided Brown had five members who had been elected to office, three former U.S. senators, one of whom had also been mayor of Cleveland, one state legislator, and one governor. They were mature, they understood the law, but also understood politics and the impact of their decisions on society. So then he cites the Citizens United, Anthony Kennedy's opinion, blithely dismissing the idea that there could be any corruption in campaign money spent independently in campaigns was the epitome of naivete. And so after he kind of talks about that, he talks about term limits, and he's a strong advocate for 18-year terms, and it kind of rotates. So every 2 years there would be a vacancy. So during a presidential term, each president during that term would appoint two justices. So that way it kind of takes away some of that urgency during presidential campaigns on like how many seats they might potentially have to fill during that term. He also said doing so would open up opportunities for men and women in their 60s, given modern life expectancies, and not just those in their 40s. It would to some degree lower the temperature on confirmation battles by making the stakes a bit lower, and it would mean a court that more accurately reflects the changes and judgments of the society. You read some of the transcripts about any case involving technology, and like you can kind of tell that the justices have a pretty poor grasp on modern technology and its implications. So I think if you had younger justices or justices more in tune with modern society, modern technology, you might get better court decisions. Also, I think he makes a good point about justices that actually have real world experience, not just in the judicial system, maybe a little bit of political savvy. I can't imagine a former president being a Supreme Court justice like Taft was. Maybe Obama. I don't think he would want to. He probably gets paid way more in the private sector than he ever would on the Supreme Court, so I don't think he'd even be interested. So it's kind of interesting to see how much the court has changed in just the past 60 years. And I think that the term limit argument definitely is pretty compelling to me.
Other proposals that you wanted to highlight from any sources?
Yes, I found a blog kind of ignominiously titled the New York Personal Injury Law Blog. I don't know how much the author or the runner of this blog is involved in personal injury versus other types of law, but he had some good suggestions. He said the term limits. He also talked about the 18-year term with a rotating vacancy every 2 years. He also talked about the Senate providing kind of the shortlist to the president, and the president would have to pick from a list of 10 or 20 or however many candidates that the president would have to choose from. And therefore, the Senate would kind of have to come together, debate, reach some sort of consensus on the short list. So that way it wouldn't be so heavily partisan. So I think that would kind of also take some of that urgency out of the presidential campaign. And he also said there should be a list of pinch hitters. As we saw with the Garland nomination, he writes, senators have a motive to leave seats empty until a president comes along from their own party. If the Democrats get a chance to get revenge and hold a seat open until the next election, they surely will do so. I'm not so sure about that. And then he said, additionally, there is sometimes an empty seat when judges must recuse themselves due to conflicts of interest. He provides a solution that if there is a vacancy due to death, retirement, or recusal, the court pulls a name at random of a sitting court of appeals judge with 10 plus years on the bench to sit by designation. This decreases the chance of senators playing politics with the court. All those are good ways to depoliticize the court. It's impossible to completely do that, but we can kind of lower the partisanship and kind of bring some neutrality back into the court, or at least increase the perceived neutrality of the court.
Although, as you said, it might be beneficial to go the opposite direction and have people with more political savvy who understand sort of the real world implications of these decisions, as opposed to writing, whether it's today or in the Redemption Court era, writing these very like elaborate, you know, states' rights and civil liberties, small government like arguments to justify sort of a political ideology that they have. Nate, briefly, do you want to talk about some of the, not necessarily in depth, but the sort of growing discussion in major circles of packing the court again, that this seems to be coming back as a possible option?
Right. Well, I was going to say, you know, there have been a lot of articles sort of advocating it, and then articles sort of going back against that, saying, oh, this would be a disaster, and the Republicans would try to do it too. And so all of that, you know, without necessarily delving into the arguments for and against each individual thing, I did think it was quite interesting in this in the long Adam Sewer article talking about how we'd be at this point actually well earlier if it wasn't for, say, Nixon, Ford, and H.W. Bush each appointing justices that turned out to be fairly liberal, at least compared to their contemporaries. That's Harry Blackmun, John Paul Stevens, and David Souter. So, you know, we may have to have this conversation, you know, whenever, eventually, as it comes. But, you know, as we've talked about, this not really the nine number. It's not. That's just kind of the legacy of the 20th century and how we think we're supposed to do things, but there's no hard and fast rule that we have to do it. So if it was set up in a way that could actually work and people were clamoring for another justice, then I could see it being supported, I guess, by the people if there's no real reason to have nine. But at the same time, you sort of wonder, the Republicans are the ones who have their, you know, long list of all their Federalist Society candidates and they're good to go and they'll just nominate. They have just, it's like a factory where they basically, and the left doesn't really have quite the same institutional setup. So that's one, you know, reason to be at least be cautious, but something to consider at least.
You know, is it going to be all Merrick Garlands all the way down if the Democrats tried to do a court packing plan?
It's,
you know,
and
is
not going to be super effective.
Is that, yeah, is that going to actually accomplish the goals that needed to be accomplished, especially with regard to, say, major economic reorganizations for dealing with climate change? Again, can't go too far into depth in the time that we have available. If you want to check out the links that we referred to today, we'll have all of those up at arsenalfordemocracy.com as always. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
And Nate, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntberg. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.